Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. A warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. I am the Bill Arnold part of that sentence. I am so glad you have joined me today. We have an outstanding show, which I can hardly wait to get to. Dr. Gary Chapman is going to be with us in just a few minutes. But I'm just moving a little slowly today. The Twin Cities Marathon was yesterday. And as a participant, I did my carb loading the 6 weeks prior to the race. And then I arrived at the race and discovered that the guy from Kenya was there, so I decided not to run. I mean, that didn't seem fair to me. But I did stick around and encourage others. I held up a Go Random Stranger sign. I thought that was nice, just to encourage everybody, because it's a huge, huge feat if you pull that off, to be able to run 26 point something miles. Personally, I'm not interested in that kind of torture, but glad, and I hope everyone was safe. It was a cool, perfect day for running yesterday here in the Twin Cities. And these things are so competitive. I mean, these people who run these marathons and win, that's like they get sponsor money and travel all over. And anyway, this guy who won ran it like in 2 hours and 10 minutes. That's like 4 minute miles. That's impressive. I'm not sure I drive 26 miles without a couple of coffee stops along the way. Anyway, Dr. Gary Chapman's going to be with us in a minute. He's written another book. You may be familiar with another book he's written called The Five Love Languages. Yep, that Dr. Gary Chapman is going to be on the program in just a minute. It's 6 minutes after the hour. Let's take a little break and get right to Dr. Chapman.
Your prayers matter and are heard by God. When you pray, lives can be changed. Each week, the Faith Radio Prayer Team joins together to pray for relationships to be strengthened, finances to be increased for God's glory, for our leaders to follow God's will, and for so much more. Will you join us? The Faith Radio Prayer Team, made up of hundreds of listeners, receives an email with each week's prayer focus. You can be a part of the Faith Radio Prayer Team by signing up at myfaithradio.com. From the opening prayer of Dr. Billy Graham in 1949.
Today this station stands as a monument to answered prayer.
Until now.
No matter what I may lose in life, I can't lose my salvation.
Faith Radio has been providing relevant Bible preaching and teaching to help you connect your faith to your life. And today, Faith Radio's programming is heard in more locations than ever before, on both the AM and FM bands. Check out myfaithradio.com for station locations and frequencies near you.
Welcome back to the show. It's 7 minutes after the hour. I think about 1992, Dr. Gary Chapman had his little book published. And that was about 10 million copies ago. And he was nice enough to join and say yes to my invitation to come on the show. He's got a new book, which I want to talk about as well. Dr. Chapman, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Bill. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Are you confident that I will never be a best-selling author if I never write a book?
I'm not confident of that, but it does sound logical.
I appreciate your logic a great deal. I mean, did you ever imagine that when you wrote this book that it would explode into this phenomena?
No. The short answer is no.
I figured.
I knew the content would help people because I've been using it in my counseling, and I knew it would help people. But no, I had no idea that now for 26 years, every year it sells more than the year before.
That is crazy.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So let's just try to, I want to talk about your newest book as well. But I mean, I know that people have heard about the five love languages and most people can recite them. But just for those who may not be super familiar with them, maybe you could just review them.
Surely. One of them is words of affirmation, using words to affirm the person. You look nice in that outfit.
Thank you.
Really appreciate what you did. You know, like what you did, just using words to affirm the person. You know, there's an ancient Hebrew proverb that says life and death is in the power of the tongue. So affirming words give life. And it is, for some people, their primary love language. And then there's gifts. It's universal to give gifts as an expression of love. The gift says, they were thinking about me. Look what they got for me. And then there's acts of service, doing something for the person that you know they would like for you to do. Bill, you remember the old saying, actions speak louder than words?
Yes.
It's true for these people.
Okay.
It's not true for everyone. But if this is their love language, actions will speak louder than words. And in a marriage, that would be such things as cooking meals and washing dishes and vacuuming floors and washing the car and changing the baby's diaper. All those kind of things. Acts of service. Then there's quality time. Giving the person your undivided attention. I do not mean husband and wife sitting on the couch watching television. Television has your attention. I'm talking about sitting on the couch with the TV off, looking at each other, talking to each other, or taking a walk down the road together as you talk, or going out to eat, assuming that you talk while you're eating. Quality time. And number five is physical touch. And we've long known the emotional power of physical touch. In a marriage, that would mean holding hands, kissing, embracing, the whole sexual part of the marriage, arm around their shoulder, driving down the road, you put your hand on their leg, or sitting around the house and they walk by and you trip them. I'm kidding on the last.
Okay? I know that. I know you are. We have called our lawyers, though, just so you know. So I'm curious.
So those are the five. And as you know, the basic idea, Bill, is that each of us has a primary love language. One of those speaks more deeply than the other four. And seldom does a husband and wife have the same love language.
Mm-hmm.
So if you simply speak your own language, that is, you do for them what you think would make you feel loved, they will not feel loved, even though you're sincere. So that book has helped couples learn how to meet the emotional need for love in a marriage or with a parent-child relationship, because the same principle is true with children. The child's greatest emotional need is to feel loved by the parents or whomever's serving as the parents.
Mm-hmm. I've just got a million questions for you. So when we think about love languages, and let's say a person is really comfortable doing one love language, but the spouse doesn't receive that as well and would really like that person to do something else. Is that a complete retraining that a person has to do, or how do we make everyone happy?
Well, here's the good news. You can learn to speak any of these languages, even if you did not receive them as a child.
That is good news.
You know, there's some people who say, I have guys who say to me, Dr. Chapman, it's just not natural for me to tell her how nice she looks and that I love her and, you know, that I appreciate her. I mean, they just didn't come easy for me. And I understand that. There is a learning curve. But the reality is you can learn to speak words. So I suggest, for example, to that guy, get you a notebook, write down sentences that you hear other people say or that you've heard through the years or something you read in a book, write them down, stand in front of the mirror, read them out loud until you hear yourself actually saying these things, and then you pick out one, and you walk in the room where she is, and you say it, and then you run. And you broke the silence. And the next time will be easier. Uh-huh. You can learn any of these languages. And if you really love and you want to communicate love, then it's worth the effort to learn to speak their love language.
So, Dr. Chapman, is it like one just rises above the others? Because if you said to someone, well, you must like touch. Oh, yeah, I like touch. Well, you must like positive words. Oh, yeah, I like positive words. Well, you must like acts of service. Yeah, I like that too. I mean, how do we decide which is the primary love language?
Well, let's face it. We're not going to walk away from any of those love languages.
No.
We can receive love in all five languages.
Okay.
But one of them will be predominant, and that's what I'm calling the primary love language. It's very similar to spoken language. All of us grew up speaking a language with a dialect, okay? That's the one we understand best.
True.
You know, like, for example, here in America, those who were born here, we basically speak English, but we have different accents. You know, I speak with a Southern accent. So it's learning what the other person's native tongue is and learning how to speak love in their language.
Mm-hmm. So does God have a primary love language, or how does he operate?
Well, you know, that's the question that led me to write this book, God Speaks Your Love Language. So many people said to me, Gary, what is God's primary love language? So I did a search through the scriptures. I mean, I took hours and days just going through the scriptures looking for the ways that God expressed his love. And I found out God speaks all five love languages, and he speaks them fluently. But here's what's interesting. He doesn't necessarily speak all five to every individual. You know, for some, it's words of affirmation. That was true for Jeremiah. You know, Jeremiah said, "Oh, Lord, your words were so meaningful to me, I ate them."
Yes.
And then he said, "When I got discouraged and I thought, well, I'm just going to give it up," he said, "your word was like a burning fire inside. I couldn't stop." So, you know, God spoke to him. Words is really what spoke to his heart. And then you got Jacob in the Old Testament. You know, he wrestled with the messenger of God. It was a physical thing. When he got through with that encounter with God, he was limping. So Old Testament and New Testament, you see God speaking all five love languages. And one of the things I did in the book after I discovered this is to just actually look at how God did speak to different people in different ways. And then I started looking at our own conversion experiences. That is, how do we actually come to Christ? And I knew this already instinctively, but it's very clear when you begin to focus on it that what brings one person to Christ is not what brings another person to Christ. You know, for example, Saul on the road to Damascus, he had a physical experience with God. He fell to his knees. His eyes were blind for a few days. I mean, God got his attention by physical touch. And today, you hear people say, you've heard them, I've heard them. They say, you know, I was just sitting there in church, and the pastor was preaching, and I just sensed God's arms around me. My body started shaking. I mean, the tears started flowing. I couldn't stop. God touched them physically.
Wow.
And brought them to faith in Christ. But not everybody has that kind of experience. But God knows how to communicate his love to us in a way that's meaningful to us, which speaks all the more of his great love for us and the fact that he created us uniquely and he knows how to communicate to us uniquely.
So, Dr. Chapman, do these love languages, can the goalposts move over time?
You know, I'm often asked that question, and I think that basically the love language, like many other traits, tend to stay with us for a lifetime.
Okay.
You can discover a child's love language, for example, by the time they're 4 years old, just by observing their behavior. My son's love language is physical touch.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was that age, when I came home, he would run to the door, grab my leg, and climb up on me. He's touching me because he wants to be touched. Our daughter never did that. At that age, she would say, "Daddy, come to my room. I want to show you something." Mm-hmm. She wanted quality time, mm-hmm. my undivided attention. They're adults now. It's still their love language. So I think it tends to stay with us for a lifetime, but I would say this, Bill. I think there may be certain seasons of life in which another love language, especially if it's very, if your number two is close to number one, that it will kind of jump to the top. For
okay.
example, a mother who has two preschool children, acts of service may not be her language, but I can tell you during those years, if the husband pitches in and helps her, it's going to speak loudly to her, maybe
mm-hmm.
more loudly than her primary love language. So I think there are situations where, or if you get enough of your number one and number two is very close, you may begin to think, oh, I don't know, I think it changed. I think my number two is number one. But if they stop giving you number one, you'll quickly know, oh, no, that's still my love language. Don't stop that.
Yeah. Okay, Dr. Chapman, I do have to take a very short break, but I'll be right back. Dr. Gary Chapman is my guest. Be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. It's 19 minutes after the hour. Dr. Gary Chapman is my guest. You know him as a author, speaker, counselor, New York Times best-selling author of The Five Love Languages. He's also written another book called God Speaks Your Love Language, How to Experience and Express God's Love. And he is graciously responding to many questions he's heard before. Dr. Chapman, do you sometimes feel like you're James Taylor being asked to sing Fire and Rain again?
You know, Bill, I never tire of speaking about the love languages.
Oh, good.
Because I know there's somebody out there that hasn't heard that. And when
Indeed.
They hear it, they're going to say, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. Is there a possessor of one of the love languages that traditionally is happier than others? I mean, if you are a person who, say, who says physical touch is just my love language, does that person stand a better chance of living a happier life? I'm trying to figure out the right way to ask this question.
Bill, I don't really think so. I think whatever your love language is, if you get it in sufficient measure, you're going to feel loved. And this is not everything to life, to be sure. But when you do feel loved by the significant people in your life, it's much easier to process all the rest of life. And so I think the key is, it's just a simple message, you know, that if you want to meet your spouse's or your child's need for love, give them heavy doses of their primary love language, sprinkle in the other four just for extra credit, and you're going to be living with a person that feels good, feels loved, feels accepted, and consequently they're more likely to reach their potential for God and good in the world.
Mm-hmm. In your book, God Speaks Your Love Language, How to Experience and Express God's Love, I know people have a hard time experiencing God's love, and you can tell them God loves you all day long, but it's until they experience it do they really feel it. Why do some people have so much struggle in that department, Dr. Chapman?
Well, I think, Bill, it's because often we compare our experience with other people's experience. You know, we hear, for example, a person who has a dramatic conversion experience, like Saul on the road to Damascus, and we say, well, you know, nothing like that happened to me. You know, it didn't happen to me. I mean, I just started reading the Bible, and then I started reading some books that people gave me, and one morning I realized, you know, I believe, and that's what happened to me. I didn't feel anything, and so they question whether or not, you know, maybe I'm not a Christian, maybe. You know, and one of the things this book does is help us understand that people have different experiences in coming to Christ. And then we also have different experiences in how we love Christ, how we express love to Christ. And here's a whole segment of the book that I really, really like, because, again, it helps us understand ourselves. Acts of service people, for example, these are the people who are most naturally going to raise their hand when somebody says, we need some folks to go work at the soup kitchen on Thursday night. Oh, they raise their hand. Why? Because in their mind, acts of service is the way you show love to God, and that's what they want to do. Another person, you know, it may be words. And if words is their language, then they're going to express love to God by, if they sing, singing words, or they pray words to God, words of praise and thanksgiving to God. You know, I use Martin Luther as an example of this. His conversion experience was hearing the simple words in the book of Romans, the just shall live by faith. And he had been working. He'd been living a disciplined life, you know, trying to get acceptance with God. And he read those words and he said, paradise broke in my soul when I realized it's faith in God's word, not my works. So what did he do once he became a follower of Jesus? He poured out his life with words of praise to God. He wrote psalms, he wrote hymns, he wrote commentaries, he wrote the 95 Theses. I mean, he wrote sermons. It was words, words, words. It was natural for him to love God by using words. But that won't be true of everybody. You know, some people, they don't know how to say words, but they can surely go down and work in the soup kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, understanding that helps you understand why some people express their love to God one way and some another way, and we don't need to be critical of people. You know, I hear people say, like acts of service people will say, well, you know, if you really love God, you'd get out there and do something.
Right.
Whereas, you know, the quality time person may be simply having lunch with a coworker and sharing life with a coworker, and eventually, you know, they share their relationship with God with the coworker, and they're not out there in the mind of the other person doing something, but really they're expressing love to God by doing what God made them to do, spending quality time with people and sharing the love of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Chapman, I would assume you've heard every question imaginable, so I'm not going to try to surprise you with a fresh one. But sometimes I think, is there a quid pro quo going on here where you say, you do this for me and I'll do that for you, and then we'll be happier together? Or Is it selfless,
you know,
love, or
you can always try to negotiate a contract? I'll do this if you do that.
Exactly.
But marriage is not a contract. Marriage is a covenant. We commit ourselves in the presence of God and witnesses that we're going to love and cherish, you know, each other. And love is not a feeling. Love is a choice. But when you choose to speak love in the proper way to a person, it does meet an emotional need for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if we understand all of this, it's going to help us in all of our relationships. But if you use the love languages to try to manipulate your spouse, you know, I'll speak your love language if you'll speak my love language.
Okay.
See, that you're just trying to negotiate a contract. That's
gotcha.
Not love.
Gotcha.
Love is the attitude which says, I know this makes you love, and I choose to do it because I love you. And then maybe they're going to reciprocate, maybe they won't. But you're loving them because you're choosing to love them.
Okay, when I think about my love language with God, is there a chance as a believer that I can fall into a kind of a routine in my relationship with Him, that I kind of pretty much do and say the same things every day, and
yeah.
He's going, oh, again.
I think, Bill, that happens often, and I deal with that in the book because it's so common.
Okay.
You know, we just go through the routine. For example, we've been having a quiet time. You know, for years we have this quiet time with God. We do the same thing every morning, in the same setting, in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And when we walk away from it, we sometimes think, we don't even know what we did. We don't remember what we read. We don't remember what happened. It's just a routine for us.
Yeah.
The same thing's true with acts of service people. You know, let's say they started working in the soup kitchen. And when they first started, when they dipped those beans and they looked up in that man's eyes on the other side of the bean, you know, they saw Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
They were dipping beans for Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
But now, that was 10 years ago. Now they still go to the soup kitchen on Thursday night, but they don't even think about Jesus. They're just dipping beans. I mean, they know they're doing a good thing.
Right.
But it's not real with them. It's just a routine with them.
Mm-hmm.
And God never intended our relationship to be routine. So what I'm suggesting in the book is two things. Number one, why don't you try some new dialects of your language? For example, if acts of service is your language and you've been working in the soup kitchen for 10 years, I'm not saying stop it, but I'm saying why don't you try some other acts of service? Maybe go rake leaves for an elderly person. Maybe go trim shrubs for somebody that can't do it themselves. Yeah, just some other acts of service. And if words is your thing, maybe pick up a hymnal and read those hymns to God rather
mm-hmm.
than using the same old words you always use.
That's...
And then maybe try to learn some of the other love languages. Maybe physical touch is not your language, okay? But the next time you walk into a nursing home and you're walking down the hallway and you see that patient sitting there in the wheelchair and they grunt when you walk by, what if you just reach over and kind of put your arm on their shoulder and kind of give them a little hug?
That's beautiful.
It'll feel uncomfortable
yeah.
the first time you do it, but you'll feel them melt in your arms. And you're speaking, you're loving God by loving them in a way that doesn't come natural for you. But I'm telling you, it speaks deeply to God because he sees you consciously doing something that's not comfortable for you.
Dr. Chapman, we've got 5 seconds left. Your love language is?
Words of affirmation.
Terrific. Thank you so much. We'll take a short break and be back in just a minute. It is 31 minutes after the hour. Happy Monday. I think it's Columbus Day, although I don't think they call it Columbus Day anymore. But thank you, Christopher Columbus, for all the hard work you did on your 3 ships, the Nina, the Pinta, and the something Maria, something. Anyway, I'll figure it out. I'll Google it. My guest in the first part of the hour, Dr. Gary Chapman, you know, we unfortunately sort of cut off at the very end, and I didn't get a chance to give him his love language, which is words of affirmation. And I'm certain he's not listening now, but I'll say it anyway. Great job, Dr. Chapman. You did wonderful. It was great having you on the show. And his book, again, is God Speaks Your Love Language, How to Experience and Express God's Love. What a delightful man. I was very honored to talk to him. And as we move along, Dr. Tim Elmore is my guest now. He's on our studio line. He's the author and founder of Growing Leaders. He's also a best-selling author, and he's an expert on Generation Y and Generation Z. So I want to learn a lot about both generations. He's here on the program. Hello, Tim. How are you?
Hey, Bill. I'm doing great. How about you?
Good. Where do you live?
I live in Atlanta, Georgia.
Sweet. I love it. I love Atlanta.
Yeah.
And what's the weather there today?
Well, it's actually October is a very great month in Atlanta. So we're done with a hot, humid time. And yet we're not into the chilly time. So It's about 75 degrees.
Sweet.
Partly cloudy, but pretty nice. We can't complain.
I love it. I love it. So I want to talk about the kind of the big mistakes parents should avoid.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. I did a book on this just a few years back, because as I travel the country, we do lots of events with schools and universities and athletic programs, but I kept meeting parents.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all well-intentioned. All of them are trying to be the super mom or the super dad of their home. But I kept seeing some unwitting mistakes, almost a pattern of unwitting mistakes that they were making. And then I looked at my own house, my own two kids, and I thought, boy, we are predispositioned to do the same thing. So I did this book called The 12 Huge Mistakes, but they all fit under four big categories. And Bill, if you'd like, I can go ahead and just toss those out.
I love the way you set this up too, Tim, because you said all these well-intentioned people, and they had no idea that they were probably making a mistake. And nobody wants to make mistakes. And if you can help us avoid them going forward, you have the floor.
That's a good thing.
You have the floor.
Yes, okay.
Yes.
Well, and I want you to know, I don't speak as some sort of expert that's got it all right, but I do speak as an observer and one that gets the undue privilege of meeting tens of thousands of moms and dads across the country.
You know,
so
I think
here
that,
are the four.
I think that makes you an expert, though. The trained observers, those are the ones that gather the information well.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Okay, so here are the four big categories. All of them, again, well-intentioned, but we did them. I think, number one, we risk too little.
Hey, what does that
number
mean?
Number two, well,
we got to take these. We got to break these down.
Okay, okay.
All right.
So risk too little simply means we have become a generation of parents that have prioritized the safety of our children.
Mm.
And it's understandable. It's gone on since the 1980s when different government centers start popping up, and we saw the photos of children on milk cartons that were missing or abducted. And, you know, we just decided we wanted to take the monkey bars and the jungle gyms off the playgrounds because Johnny might fall out and break his arm, you know, those kinds of things. But in our effort to produce safety, which is totally understandable, I want my kids safe, we sent an unwitting message, never take a risk. And so some kids today not only experience FOMO, fear of missing out, but they experience FOMU, fear of messing up, because we've sent them a message, don't mm-hmm. make any mistakes, don't ever fail. Sometimes we have parents that are negotiating with the child's teacher and trying to negotiate a B out of a C or whatever, because they just don't want them to ever make any mistakes. So I think we just I think we need to remember that some of the greatest lessons in life come when we fail or we fall, and we have to figure it out, and we have to use our faith to get back up, you know, that sort of thing. But who wants their kid to fail? Nobody. So we've just gone overboard, I think, on this protective thing. And what I often say, Bill, to parents when I'm doing conferences, I say, folks, we've done a much better job protecting than preparing. And I think one of the ultimate jobs of parenting is let's get them ready for the world they're about to enter into as adults.
So, Tim, have we completely lost a piece of growing up? Because I remember, and maybe you do as well, where you would get up in the morning on a summer day or a Saturday, and you would literally disappear from your house for about 8 hours.
Yeah.
And you would go down to the ballpark, and you would choose captains, and you would pick teams, and you would self-regulate, and you would call balls and strikes, or they were out or safe. And that's the way things worked, and you managed relationships that way.
That's exactly right. So many skills were built
on
an unsupervised ball field. So that's one of the symptoms of what I'm talking about. Children today have very few hours that are unsupervised by adults. And while I understand that, we needed time out there just figuring it out. I learned conflict resolution on a ball diamond. I
mm-hmm.
did. And today there might be four mothers out there doing that conflict resolution for the kids. So I don't mean to overspeak, but I think listeners might know we really have been prescriptive in our leadership. We're prescribing every step and staying over. Don't forget your backpack. Don't forget your quiz on Friday. Don't forget your grandma's birthday. Da, 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 da. And I'm thinking kids won't grow up if we do all this heavy lifting for them. They've got to take some risks. And the only way you learn it is not on a video. It's by taking risks.
Mm-hmm. The problem with what you just said, though, is if parents say, yeah, I need to take more risks, and the 9-year-old takes the dog on a walk by herself, and they call the county authorities because of child neglect,
yeah.
Then what?
No, that's exactly right. In fact, Utah became the first state that just passed some legislation that this was not, what you just described, is not child neglect or child.
Oh, good. You know, good.
I know, it's crazy, but you're right. It's very rare because we think any unsupervised child, there must be neglectful parents going on here,
mm-hmm.
And it's not at all. Let me give you a classic illustration. I mentioned just a minute ago about monkey bars. So many listeners, I bet you, would remember about 20-some years ago, the playgrounds of America began to change. The monkey bars and jungle gyms were yanked off because parents got scared that their child might fall off. Immediately, psychologists began to write papers saying, wait, you do realize, don't you, that those same monkey bars that they use at 8 years old help them develop motor skills that they're going to need in their 20s when they navigate risks like moving out of the house or doing the big job interview or asking someone to marry them. But alas, we took the monkey bars off the playgrounds. Well, 20 years later, the kids are now not 6 or 7 or 8. They're 26, 27, 28. Psychologists are now writing white papers basically saying we are seeing a disproportionate amount of young adults who are having phobias about normal risk-taking ventures, like the ones I just listed. And I'm thinking, now, it's not all monkey bars, but it's that parent that's hovering over their child, well-intentioned, but not letting the kid grow into an adult.
Wow. And I feel like that ship has sailed.
Yes, it has. So we're doing our darndest to help moms and dads say, now, at 8 years old, 8-year-old risk, not a lot, but little. At 18, a lot more risk. And we need to. Here's what I would say. We need to prepare the child for the path, not the path for the child.
Okay, that was well said. We have to say that again. We have to.
We need to prepare the child for the path, any path.
Okay.
That they need to be ready for, rather than the path for the child. I think far too often moms and dads have tried to pave the way and pave the path, and so it's easy for their child. Well, gosh, I want my kids to be ready for any trials or tribulations, if you will, that come their way. They're ready.
Yeah.
So it's about readiness. Yeah.
Okay. Now, let's move on to the second one. I also want to invite listeners, if they want a piece of you, because, you know, I want them to be able to ask you questions as well.
Absolutely.
Which I just want to throw the number out, 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. You can grill Tim with a question if you like. But let's move on to another mistake parents should avoid.
Okay. So number one is we risk too little. Number two is we rescue too quickly. So this is a second cousin, but it's a different category. I think everybody listening, if you're a mom or a dad especially, know what rescuing looks like. At elementary school, it might be running down that backpack they forgot or the gym shorts they forgot. By middle school, it might be, like I said, negotiating with a teacher for a better grade on behalf of your child, and we're, again, rescuing them there. By high school, my gosh, we're trying to help them navigate getting into the college they want to get into. And while all of that is understandable, in fact, I think most people would say, isn't that normal? Again, it prevents the child from becoming the adult, the self-sufficient adult they really need to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have lost count, Bill, of the number of university deans that have said to me, 26 is the new 18. Now, you know what I'm saying there.
Yes, I do.
What we once expected at 18, you're a man now, let's take responsibility, let's take initiative. It's now happening much later. And I don't think it's because the kids aren't talented or smart. I think we've done the heavy lifting again when we should have said, I'm going to trust you to do this. I believe in you. By the way, let me just say this. What message, mom and dad, are we sending to our children when we rescue them? Aren't we Superman and they're Lois Lane? And they're thinking, oh, I need them to do my life. And I'm going, no, I want my kids to go, my dad, my mom got me ready to do this. So can I tell you a funny story? I don't know if it's funny or sad.
I better laugh.
Here it is.
Yeah.
Yes, you better laugh. You judge. So some years ago, I got a I got the first email on this very topic from a professor at the University of Syracuse. She said, Tim, I just handed out the first set of tests to my first year students here at Syracuse. She said, one of the young ladies in my class got a C minus. Well, she had never, ever gotten a C minus in her life up to that point. So she had a meltdown right there in class. So that's problem number one, a meltdown over a C minus. So, oh, meltdown. Everybody's looking at this poor girl. She's having her meltdown. The first thing she thinks to do is to reach in her backpack, pull out her cell phone, and text her mom. Mom makes the mistake of texting right back and saying, call me right away. So right there in class, the student calls her mom.
In class.
You know, cell phone Yeah. So cell phone conversations are kind of loud, so nothing else can happen, you know, as we all listen into the cell phone call. If that's not bad enough, it climaxes next. The student says, okay, mom. She hands the phone to the teacher, to the professor, and says, she wants to talk to you.
Oh, no.
I'm serious.
Oh, no.
And, of course, mom was going to negotiate a B minus out of the C minus. I wish I could tell you that was an isolated incident. Happens hundreds of thousands of times all year long, every year. I talk to educators. I would either make you laugh or cry for the next hour. But all I'm saying is, listeners, I love you, but you've got to begin to say, well, let me just roll the tape back. What if the mom texted back and said, sweetheart, call me tonight? And then later that night in the dorm, she could have said, honey, I am so sorry you got a C minus. I know it's a first. You're such a good student. But can I give you some good news? I got five of them in college, and I totally made it. It's no big deal. Now, what you need to do is go into that prof and say, what do I need to do to bring this grade up? Love you. Bye. I know that sounds cruel, but I'm saying that's what gets them ready. It's lifting weights in the gym that makes us stronger, not looking at the weights and having someone do it for us.
Right. All right, Tim,
I know I'm preaching to the choir, but I'm telling you.
No, that was a fantastic story. But, you know, when you talk about rescuing too quickly, let's say mom told their son or daughter, do not take your cell phone near the pool, and then they do that and they drop it in the pool and the cell phone's ruined. Do the parents race out and get them a new one later that night? Because they, let's face it, they can't be without a cell phone.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of idea of rescuing too quickly, or are we learning consequences at all?
Yeah, that's the problem, obviously. When we rescue, they really don't learn there are consequences to poor decisions. And here's what I would say. Now, listeners, I just want you to ponder this. Even if you don't agree, please listen. I would suggest that the cell phone gets dropped in, you think through what it's an appropriate consequence. Maybe it is going without a cell phone for a little while, and then you think through what's the weight that needs to be carried. In our house, when our kids were growing up, they're both adults now, when they were growing up, we had very few rules but lots of equations. Here's the difference. First of all, we had like three rules in our house. They were pretty basic. I don't know any kid that actually loves rules. Consequences are a part of life, and consequences basically say, if you do that, then this is the benefit. If you do this, then that is the consequence. You follow what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm just saying, moms and dads, every time there is a decision that needs to be made, there's an opportunity that they want to capitalize on, we need to be thinking, okay, what's the equation that we level or we communicate, and then we stick to our guns. So with our kids, we did a phone contract. So when they got a cell phone, they got a contract because we bought the phone. So they could never say, this is my phone. Actually, no, Bethany, I loaned it to you. It's my phone. Unless you'd like to make the payments on it. Would you like to do that at 13 or, you know, whatever?
Mm-hmm.
So now I know that may sound harsh to a listener right now, but it was just helpful from the very get-go that she knew there's an equation here and contracts are going to be the rest of my life. I'm going to have contracts the rest of my life. So I guess the long answer long answer to a short question. I think we need to be thinking through what's the consequence. Even if we do get them a phone, what is the penalty they're going to have to pay that makes them think, I'm going to have some muscle memory here and be more careful next time. And again, it may not be learned overnight, but over time, equations actually teach us best.
All right, Tim, let me take a little break. Dr. Tim Elmore is my guest. He's the author and founder of Growing Leaders. If you have a question for him, we've got two mistakes that parents should try to avoid making in the can. Two more to go. 877-933-2484. Otherwise, we'll be right back. It is 11 minutes until the top of the hour. Dr. Tim Elmore is my guest, and he's doing a fine job. He's the author and founder of Growing Leaders. We're talking about four huge mistakes parents should avoid. And we've got two down, two to go. First one was we risk too little and we rescue too quickly. Tim, what should we discuss next?
The third one is we rave too easily. Now, let me tell you what I mean by that. First of all, I want people to know I'm an encourager of kids. We work with students, tens of thousands every year, love them, love my own two kids. But I feel like we live in a day of hyperbole. For instance, don't you agree, Bill, maybe the word awesome may be overused just a little bit.
Uh-huh.
In fact, when everything's awesome, we wonder what really is, you know?
Yeah. I don't use awesome unless I'm talking about myself, but go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, you and God, that's it. Well, and then, you know, we put 5 exclamation points. Now it needs to be 6 to really make our point. It's like we're shouting in our texts and our social
media. Right, right.
So we started saying things like, you're awesome to our children just for putting the fork in the dishwasher. We started putting, you know, giving trophies out just for participating in the sport. And it was all well-intended,
mm-hmm.
no doubt about it. We meant well. But, again, good psychology, good human psychology says that self-esteem is not raised just through affirmation alone. It's through affirmation and achievement. So I believe that when we just rave about everything, number one, our words lose their meaning, but number two, it disconnects them from reality. Pretty soon by middle school, a kid's going, you know what, Mom? You're the only one saying I'm awesome. Nobody else is saying I'm awesome. So pretty soon they're not believing, Mom, and they're actually believing their peers, which are saying otherwise, and sometimes it's cyberbullying maybe. So it's just not a wise thing to do. So the remedy is this, I think. Carol Dweck, a Stanford psychologist, really, really did us a favor when she did some research at Columbia University when she was in New York. I'm going to try to make this quick, but it's a great experiment. She found out that 85% of American parents believe it's important to tell your child you're smart. And the reason parents do that is we feel like it's going to give them a little confidence the next time they take an exam of some sort. But she was seeing those students every day, and she started realizing, I think it's backfiring. So in the experiment that she talks about in her books, she says she divided two groups of 10-year-old children and gave each one of them a test, a similar test. At the end of the test, one group was told, you must be smart. The other group was told, you must have really tried hard. Now, do you see the difference there?
Oh,
one
yeah.
was for smarts. One was for effort.
Mm-hmm.
A second round of tests were given that were much harder, and they were given the option to not take it. Many of the students in the first group who had just been told they were smart didn't want to take the test, and they thought it was weird. In fact, wouldn't you think if they were just encouraged, they would do more? It did the opposite.
No, I don't want to blow my perfect record.
Exactly. That's what they found out.
Yeah.
And doesn't that make sense? You go,
total.
I'm just going to stop with I'm awesome. You know?
Yeah, I'm going to quit while I'm ahead.
I don't want to test that. That's right. Quit while I'm ahead. Now, what's funny is the ones who had been affirmed for effort actually wanted to take the test. And even though it was harder and many of them didn't do great, they loved the challenge of the test. The final part of the experiment, they gave another round of tests appropriate for their age level, and the kids in the first group actually did 30% worse. And Carol and her team could not figure it out. But here's what they found out after they debriefed with all the students. Bottom line, the kids basically were saying, well, if I'm so smart, I shouldn't have to try so hard. Well, that makes sense. So you tell me I'm awesome, I expect all this awesomeness around me. You tell him I'm beautiful, I should be asked out by every guy in the school. You tell him, you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think that makes me say, first of all, let me affirm effort or qualities that are in their control more than out of their control. Secondly, I want to attach them to reality. If they did a good job, say, sweetheart, you did a good job. Not, this was the most awesome thing in the world. We need to just be real. And I think as Christ followers, we ought to be real. And that doesn't mean we stop affirming. It means we connect it to variables that are in their control. So one quick example. With my kids, this changed me as a dad. Instead of saying, Bethany, you're gorgeous, which I still would say from time to time because I love my daughter. I would say, Bethany, I love the empathy you show for your friends. It's such a great trait. Bethany, I love how honest you are. Now, see, those are variables that are under control. That's effort. That's not, you know, she can say, well, I can repeat that. And what gets rewarded gets repeated. So I feel like our affirmation doesn't need to be zilch. It needs to be, let's make it real and let's connect it to variables that are in their control rather than out of their control.
So, Tim, when you go speak to big groups, do you make any friends?
You know what I often hear? You could probably predict this. Mid-M come up sheepishly and go, good grief, I think I made all 12 of those mistakes. What do I do now? My child's 16 or 18 or 21.
Right.
And I don't think it's too late. I know you're kind of being silly here, but it's not too late. But I think what may have to happen is what I had to do with my two kids when they were older as teenagers, like 18, 19. I sat down with them and I said, could I ask your forgiveness? I don't know if I did this dad thing really well on a certain couple of places. And I apologized. And I don't think I was horrible, but, you know, and I even listened. And it was so rich because, you know, whenever a parent actually gets real like that, they go, of course you're forgiven, you know.
Right.
But then now you're at a level playing field and you could go, what can we do now to remedy this where I may have built into you a wrong mindset? But, you know, and now you're collaborating as two, one young adult, one older adult, rather than I'm going to try to pretend like nothing went wrong. You know, that's
yeah. All right, Tim, we've just got a couple minutes left, so I'd like to get the fourth one in, which is we reward too frequently.
Yes. So this one's built off of the whole notion that prizes and ribbons and trophies being given out either for nothing or for just participation. Once again, I know I alluded to that earlier, but I just think while it's a well-intentioned mistake and might even work when they're 5 years old, it doesn't work when they're 9 years old and certainly not after. I know one little boy that gave the trophy back to his dad after the Little League baseball season was over. He goes, Dad, this doesn't mean anything. So the kids aren't dumb. I just wonder if we are.
And the kids know the score, too, regardless of the age.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They really
we're not fooling anybody.
Yes, so we mean well. I think it's something for a preschool, maybe 0 to 5. But I think after that, what you do when you stop doing that is you start teaching them how to deal with frustration and with loss, and let's get them again next year. I remember one time in Little League Baseball, one season, we lost every game. I didn't get one trophy, but you know what it did in me? It made me think, we're going to get them next year. We're going to get, you know, and yeah. I wanted to come back with more resilience rather than, great. I get a trophy for either playing or not playing. I might as well stop trying. And I think that happens. So can I give you a really current example of this?
Yeah, wait 1 minute.
One teacher in Florida recently got fired from her school because the school asked her to give 50% grade for students that turned nothing in. And she went, wait, if you turn nothing in, you get a zero. No, 50%.
Oh, wow.
Well, she got fired because she wouldn't do it. And the point was she said, this is not teaching life, and I know we've got to teach how life works when the stakes are low and they're young rather than wait until they're high and they're now their boss is firing them because they got a zero. So I'll stop there.
Well, that's okay. You know, Tim, I just timed this poorly because I could keep talking for at least another half hour. So maybe you'd come back and we can continue
absolutely.
The discussion we've started. I know we probably have sadly stepped on a few toes today, and I know that was not your intention. But, you know,
you
make mistakes and it hurts. And all the things you shared today are so valid. And I would love to continue. So we'll have you back on the show. Thank you so much. Dr. Tim Elmore has been my guest. Where do we go to find out more about you?
Yeah, our website's probably the quickest and easiest. There's lots of free stuff there and then also things you could get for yourself purchase. It's simply growingleaders.com.
Perfect.
Growingleaders.com.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.